Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Peter Reiling from the Aspen Institute, and I have a very simple task here, which is to welcome you to this afternoon's tutorial, U.S. Leadership in Global Affairs, and to thank Booz Allen Hamilton yet again for their sponsorship of this and the other sessions we've been having throughout the week. So without further ado, let me turn it over to Andrea Mitchell. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter. Thank all of you for coming. I'm Andrea Mitchell. I think I know most of you, but I'm a foreign affairs correspondent for NBC News, and we're pleased to have our friends here today, Peter Feaver from the National Security Council, a special advisor to Steve Hadley, and a political science professor at Duke University, and of course Jim Steinberg, who is the dean of the School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, formerly the head of policy planning at the State Department, deputy national security advisor during the Clinton administration, and the head of the Foreign Policy Department at Brookings. Gentlemen, we're here to talk about the U.S. role in global leadership. Obviously, the last remaining superpower has both opportunities and responsibilities, and lately it has seemed more on the responsibility side of the ledger. Peter, what should our role be when you weigh unilateral action versus multilateral action? Here we face a potential crisis with North Korea and resistance from both China and Russia to let us proceed as we think we ought to with a sanctions resolution at the United Nations. How do you determine when we work with our allies, friends, and not exactly allies, but colleagues at the United Nations, and when we go off on our own, as we have most notably with Iraq?
Well, I think we'll be discussing all of those over the next hour and a half, so I'll touch on a few of those, and then we can come back to it in more questions. First, let me say it's a privilege to be on the same stage with my betters, and I've been enjoying the week here at Aspen, and I've felt, as I look forward to this event, that I was very much in a minority, and I began to feel like I was the tethered goat for the Colosseum. And then I was very grateful to remember that Carl is coming tomorrow morning, and don't waste any of your ammunition on me. Save it for Carl.
An even bigger goat.
Yes. He's the 800-pound goat. But my wife, who sat in a session with Jim earlier, said he's doing a wonderful job and he's always smiling. Be sure to smile. So I shall try to do my best. My problem, though, is that the more interesting I am, the more I put my job in jeopardy. And that's a disadvantage that I'm at. But let me step back at your question. I think that there's a confusion in the debate or the discussion about unilateralism and multilateralism. I think there are really three approaches. There is the unilateral approach, doing things alone, without any other partner. And every president has always reserved the right to do that. The United States does that very, very rarely. And it's hard to identify times when this administration or any administration has done things unilaterally. Almost always, United States prefers to act with partners, that is, multilaterally. But there are two forms of multilateralism. There's formal multilateralism through the United Nations or through NATO or through the World Trade Organization, et cetera. And the United States most of the time is operating through formal institutions. And then there's informal, what I would call informal multilateralism, sometimes called coalitions of the willing. But that is finding partners who share the same sense of urgency about a problem, share the same basic sense of the way forward, and then acting. And I would argue that a lot of times when we're doing informal multilateralism, it gets wrongly labeled as unilateralism. And there, we should recognize that each of these approaches is a means towards an end, that is, towards dealing with a problem and not an end in itself. And you see that with North Korea or our approach to Iran. We are picking amongst the range of approaches that's tailored to solving the problem rather than letting the approach be an end to itself. The downside of multilateralism is that states don't always agree with us, and you're seeing that with North Korea. Japan agrees with us emphatically and sees that situation roughly the same way we do, but other partners like China has a slightly different take, and that's what negotiations, diplomacy about, is trying to persuade and cobble together a group of nations that will act in the same way. And I would argue that has been the modal approach that we've taken and that the previous administration took.
Jim, do you agree that this administration has approached issues, including Iraq, multilaterally, or is that almost symbolic?
No, I agree with Peter's description of the way the administration has been proceeding, but there is a different way to do it. First, let me say I'm delighted to be here with Peter, not only because this wonderful system we have of being able to have the revolving door and be able to bring people in from academia and the think tank world to be part of government, I think really enriches our capabilities as a nation. It also gives us some place to rest when we're not in government, so that's quite a good thing. And I also applaud both Peter and Steve Hadley for creating this position, that it's a strategic planning type position, which we need more of in our government. I mean, the biggest challenge, I think, that many of us face when we're in government is the problem that is the tyranny of the day-to-day and the inability to see beyond. I was privileged to be at policy planning, which was a piece of that, but we really haven't had a policy planner at the NSC, and Peter's been able to do some of that. And I think it really has helped, and I think it is part of what I see as a much more nuanced approach overall in President Bush's second term. Nonetheless, I do have some disagreements with Peter about this, because the problem with this theory of a coalition of the willing is that it's treating every international crisis as a pickup game. And you sort of look around, you see who's available, and you see who'll join your team. But the problem is that if you don't have a team that's already prepared and training together and working together and committed to each other, you're in great danger that when the time comes to go and the whistle blows for the start of the game, that there won't be anybody there, or the people that you have there will be very weak, or people who are there simply because they're very dependent on you, rather than the partners that you really need. Secretary Rumsfeld very famously said that the approach of this administration was going to be the mission determines the coalition, not the coalition determining the mission. And on a kind of superficial level, that sounds very attractive. But the problem is that if we're not willing to spend the time and take seriously how our coalition partners see the problem, take their different views, try to find a common ground, they're going to be less and less willing. They're going to say, look, you always get your way. You do it your way. If we happen to agree, then you want us to come along. If you don't happen to agree, we don't want you to come along. And I want to just give two examples of both what happened, and I think was unfortunate, of this approach, and second, I think another way of doing it. After 9/11, as you all recall, it's really an extraordinary moment, a great tragedy for the United States, but one in which the world really rallied around the United States and really supported us. And we got very good international support, both at the UN and at NATO. NATO even invoked this famous provision of the NATO Treaty, Article 5, that said this was an attack on one of its members, we should all come to each other's defense. But the administration chose not to use those mechanisms. They were grateful for the support, but rather than going to NATO and using that as a vehicle, there was a sense that, well, operationally we had a big problem here. We wanted to do it, you know, where we could do it, what we saw as our most militarily effective terms. And so there were some NATO members who participated, but there was a general sense in which we weren't going to use these mechanisms, that we were reluctant to get too many of the allies involved. And it's understandable from a military operational position, very difficult. And so, obviously, we did a great job. It was a terrific military victory in the early stages of Afghanistan. But then when the time comes to sort of follow on, a lot of countries are in this attitude and said, well, look, you didn't really need us. You didn't really want us as part of this. How supportive are we going to be? And now, as we try to get NATO to pick up the pieces, what we're seeing is a fairly half-hearted effort, in my judgment, by NATO allies. And I do think part of that is the failure to really believe in the mechanism and be willing to take the costs of acting as an alliance. The flip side is what happened in Kosovo. When we were thinking about intervening in Kosovo, there was a lot of pressure in 1998 as the crisis began to develop for the United States to go in. But our European allies weren't ready to do it. They said we need more diplomacy. And there was understandable frustration in the human rights community in the U.S., a lot of political figures, go, 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 people are dying. We chose to wait. We chose to do the diplomacy, even though we were deeply skeptical that it would work, because we believed that at the end of the day, if we went through this, that the NATO allies would be there when we needed to go in, and we would have a political coalition that would be strong and would resist, would stay together through the difficulties of war and conflict. And it worked. And we paid a price. We had a much more complex military operation. There were all these terrible stories about targets being picked at NATO and the like, and those were realities. We did pay that price for it. But at the end of the day, I believe we prevailed because we had the political solidarity of all the NATO countries being together. So that's the difference, in my judgment, between the two kinds of multilateralism, between the coalition of the willing and the belief, another to mix the metaphors, that if you want people to be there on the landing for you, you got to take them with the takeoff, too. And that means giving them a voice, dealing with them, taking seriously their differences of opinion, trying to find common ground before you start, rather than saying, come on along, boys, join us, here's where we're going.
Let me just suggest, however, that without refighting the diplomacy that led to the Iraq War, you had a situation where the president did on September 12th, 2002, go to the United Nations and ask for support. Colin Powell in November had a unanimous resolution, which was the work of real diplomacy by him and by former UN Ambassador Negroponte, and then got sandbagged by the French, who called a meeting to talk about terrorism, and it ended up being a food fight over Iraq policy. Here, again, with North Korea, you have the administration, certainly with the United States, has a very good pretext here to ask for some UN Security Council support for action against North Korea. Japan is eager, South Korea less so to a certain extent, but China, which claims to be an economic superpower, and Russia, which is going to be hosting the G8, is once again opposing American interests in terms of this resolution. So it's well and good for many critics and those of us in the media to call for this administration to press for multilateral approaches. But what do you do when these major players, Peter, are consistently opposing our interests?
Well, and I would go a step further. I'd point out that in Kosovo, the Clinton administration chose not to go to the UN, even though under the UN charter, that was the venue that they should have gone to deal with the situation in the Balkans. They didn't because they understood correctly that Russia would veto any action and that would block multilateral action. And that's in sharp contradistinction to the way the present administration handled the Iraq War. They actually went to the UN. They took the Iraq matter to the UN, unlike what was done in Kosovo. And it's also fair to say that while the Kosovo War ended happily, it was a much closer run thing than perhaps it needed to be. Jim's colleague wrote a book describing it as winning ugly. And I think there may have been some overlearning of the lessons of the Kosovo War in the month after 9/11, desperately trying to avoid that kind of paralysis that put the NATO alliance, frankly, at risk of losing its first war ever in Kosovo, or at least being broken up, the coalition being broken up because of Milosevic's intransigence. I also am not sure I would characterize NATO's involvement in Afghanistan as half-hearted. Now, right now, they are exercising their Chapter 5 obligations in Afghanistan exactly as we would want them to do, and they are paying a price for it. They are fighting and dying in Afghanistan, and I don't think we should, and I know you weren't minimizing it, but I mean, for the rest of the audience, we shouldn't minimize the bravery and the sacrifice of our allies. But here's the point that you're making. Our allies, and sometimes I call them other in-laws, they're sometimes, they function a little bit like in-laws, have their own interests.
I hope your in-laws are not here today.
Yes, I love my in-laws. Let me just say for the record, I love my in-laws, and I love my wife.
No comparison to China.
No, but but they have their own interests, and they approach these conflicts with their own strategic calculus, weighing costs and benefits. And this is the problem. It can't be overemphasized. It's blindingly obvious when you're in the job dealing with it on a day-to-day basis. It's less obvious from the outside. But the same allies and strategic partners that will complain about U.S. action or inaction in the world publicly will privately send us to Marcia saying, why aren't you doing something about this problem? You need to take a bigger role in dealing with this problem. So there's a difference between their public stance sometimes and their private stance. But the bottom line is there's tremendous incentives for them to free ride off of American leadership. That is to say, let America bear a disproportionate part of the burdens and the costs of dealing with these problems. And America, as the sole superpower, provides these international public goods. And there's a rich political science theory about why the United States will function that way, and we tend to function that way, but it's what makes multilateral fora, particularly formal multilateral fora that give veto to other actors, so difficult to work.
I certainly agree, Peter. You don't want to be an institutional fetishist where you say that whatever the institution is, you have to have it there. We had an interesting discussion in an earlier panel about the difference between the European attitude, which is values institutions for institution's sake, and an American view, which sees them in pragmatic terms. If an institution can't meet its responsibilities, if the Security Council can't meet its responsibilities, you do have to think about other alternatives. And I think, to just correct the record, Peter, I mean, in fact, the situation was very similar in Kosovo, because we had a resolution on Kosovo that was similar to 1441 that demanded that Milosevic withdraw and end the repression. And we acted, I think it was 1241, in some respects on a similar theory. And I certainly entirely at the time supported the administration in going to the UN for the resolution 1441, precisely because Iraq was in violation of its Security Council resolutions, and that if we want the Security Council to be relevant, the Security Council ought to step up to what's needed. I think one of the interesting questions, and I don't want to get into extended debate about Iraq, is really was a timing question more than a philosophy question, which was at the time the decision was made, there were a number of countries, and we can debate what France's position was or wasn't, and I certainly would not defend the behavior of the individual foreign minister in question, but there was a proposal by the Chileans for a delay to move forward. And I understand the frustration and the sense that we needed to go when we needed to go, but we were not facing an imminent crisis. And that's one of the things that I think is very important in looking at these choices we have to make. If you're under immediate threat, where there's a missile is about to be launched, an attack is supposed to be taken, sure, you want your friends, but you're going to do what you need to do. But when you're dealing with these more complex preventive situations, and I shared a lot of the anxiety and concern about Iraq, but given the opportunity to strengthen the international coalition, instead of going then and trying to build the case, which might not have worked. It might have been that we had delayed and people said, oh, we're just looking for excuses. That might have been the case. But it's hard to say in retrospect that we didn't go that extra mile to see whether we could get that extra support. And that's why I think the administration is doing the right thing right now, both vis-a-vis Iran and North Korea, which is to say, yes, we feel a sense of urgency. We are going to try to push this forward as far as we can, but we're not going to get ahead of our skis here, that we recognize that the Iran problem is urgent, but it's not imminent. It is critical that we get it resolved, but we have a much better chance of getting it resolved if we bring the Russians and the Chinese along. And I'm not convinced that through this patient diplomacy, including a very wise move by Secretary Rice to move to offering the possibility of discussions, that we don't have a better chance of getting Russia and China to come on board, because their objections to our actions will be less. And I see some evidence that there is a better understanding between the United States on the one hand, and the United States and Europe on the one hand, and Russia and China, that if you work this process through, of course we have to push and we have to provide leadership. But again, it's not getting too far ahead of ourselves and recognizing that sometimes our perception will differ and we can afford to be more flexible and do the work that an unpleasant, difficult, you know, frustrating kind of engagement with some characters who have a lot of old-fashioned ways of talking and doing business.
I
wanted to raise the question of Iran and later North Korea and the potential impact that the Iranian offer, the offer that we made on May 31st, might have had on whatever the calculus is, if one can ever understand what's happening in Pyongyang. Today, Ahmadinejad gave a speech, and it's reported by the wires that he said that foreign terrorists should stop crossing the border into Iraq because that was giving the foreign forces, the U.S., an excuse to stay longer. So it sounded, it's hard to read the tea leaves, as though he was responding to the recent complaints from Washington about the step-up of Iranian terror-supported terror within Iraq, to the insurgency, and it sounded like a more moderate speech. At the same time, Larijani is telling Solana and the EU that he will not meet the deadline this coming Wednesday, that the EU foreign ministers, the group of the foreign ministers, and that Secretary Rice has imposed for Iran to respond to this offer. So at this stage, are we flexible about, this is certainly not a hard deadline on the 12th, but they wanted to clear this up before the G8 next weekend. Do we wait for Iran? Is, as Jim says, there's nothing urgent about this? Do we let the diplomacy flow, as it certainly seems to be the signal from Washington, from the administration, that it's going to? And how do we read whether Iran is eventually going to come around? Is it possible to understand what was happening in Tehran?
Let me just make one point about Iraq, and then I'll get to Iran. I think that in classes that Jim teaches and that I teach for the next 30 years, we'll be debating about the spring 03, what would have happened if we had waited another 6 weeks or so. I take the lesson of the Dulfer Report as being
Charles Dulfer.
Charles Dulfer, who after about a year and a half of unfettered inspections in Iraq, and it took him that long, unfettered inspections, unfettered interviews. Crucially, this is the crucial part. He could interview scientists who were no longer in fear that Saddam Hussein was in power and would kill them if he answered. It took him that long to reach the conclusion that Saddam Hussein was trying to deceive the world that he had stockpiles while having gotten rid of a lot of his old stockpiles, while preserving the capacity to continue to build new ones, but not activating those programs at this moment. That's the complex picture of the Dulfer Report. And I am highly confident that Hans Blix would not have discovered that fact after six more weeks or even six more months, because no matter how we structured the inspections while Saddam Hussein was still in power, we weren't going to get that kind of unfettered access. But I realize that historians will debate this long after I'm dead. Let me get to the Iran. The situation with Iran is that we have the challenge of coming up with a middle way between the two alternatives that seem to be staring the world in the face, which was either you let Iran develop nuclear weapons or you have to use the military option to stop it. And both of those options were highly undesirable. And the president said, I want an alternative option. And the EU3 process, which we supported, had run its course and had been unable to accomplish that middle option. And so what the president's decision, which the secretary announced, about we would be willing to join the EU negotiations, provided that Iran suspended their enrichment, and then that would pave the way for a deal on nuclear issues. We would even endorse civilian nuclear power for Iran. These are pretty dramatic changes from, you know, decades of U.S. policy. We were willing to do that. All of that was an effort to create that middle option. I agree with Jim that it's not an urgent in the sense of hours crisis. On the other hand, if you string negotiations out for months and months while Iran continues to enrich, eventually Iran will have crossed the point of no return, where it doesn't matter what deal is struck on paper, they will have a de facto nuclear weapons capability. And so this deal, if it's going to be meaningful at all, has to be struck before then. That is why the secretary has put a timeline, not a hard deadline of by, you know, midnight of such and such a date, but why there's a greater sense of urgency, perhaps, than you might have gotten the impression from what Jim said.
Let me ask you, Jim, whether, and feel free to comment on this, Peter, whether you think the situation with Iran would have been easier to deal with before this president of Iran took office under Khatami, and before, and perhaps without, the president having described them as an axis of evil. You know, could we have cut a better deal when they weren't as oil wealthy because the price of oil wasn't $75 a barrel and they had a different government if we had not labeled them a member of the axis of evil?
Well, you put a lot of factors into the equation, and they're all important, and it's hard to disentangle all of them. I do believe that the demonization is a problem. I mean, at the end of the day, we are going to need to find a way to reach a modus vivendi on terms that meet our national interest with these countries. And when you demonize them, when you, as we have done both with Iran and North Korea, it just makes it that much harder to get to the agreement. Doesn't mean we should sweep it under the rug. The realities of both regimes are terrible. They are absolutely terrible, and we should deal with their behavior rather than demonizing them as individuals, because that's what we're really talking about here. We need to make clear what our national interests are. We don't like a lot of regimes in the world, and yet we deal with them. And the question vis-a-vis both of these regimes are, can we reach some kind of understanding that is consistent with our national interest, or do you believe that the only answer is regime change? And there were some who argued in this administration, early on at least, that really there was no point. They couldn't be trusted. They were inherently bad and evil, and that was the signal of the access of evil. So that meant, well, really, the only answer, if they're evil, is you have to get rid of them. Well, if you tell a regime that your objective is to change them, they're going to dig in their heels, and they're going to see how can they protect themselves. And again, you can't sort of say, what would have happened otherwise. But it's not unreasonable for both the governments of Tehran and North Korea to look at the Iraq experience and say, the United States, if it's in a position to do it and to change a regime, and maybe for good reason, will do it, and so we better make it harder for them to do it. And that's a motivation down the nuclear path. So I think that one of the things that Secretary Rice's initiative has done is it's taken it out of that dynamic and basically said, we don't like you, but we're going to deal with your behaviors. And we're going to first start on the nuclear problem because that is critical to our national security. And as we talk to them, we've got to talk to them about terrorism. We've got to talk to them about their involvement in the peace process. And I think that's the right strategy of dealing even with odious regimes of the sort that we're dealing with here. There's no question that the economic situation of Iran has given them a lot more flexibility, not only because they have the resources from $70 a barrel oil, but also because of the overall global supply situation. That means if we're going to take a tough line and really go after them, we could be playing a very, very intense game of chicken over global economics if they are willing to take the short-term price to take their oil off the market.
Now, Peter, I know you were not involved in the crafting of that speech. There's an interesting history to that.
Which be Shamani Dajad's speech?
No, not that, I assume. The Axis of Evil speech.
Right.
The interesting thing about that is that people in the State Department and in the NSC didn't really, it was a speechwriter's phrase, and no one really thought that it would have foreign policy implications. Do you think that it did?
Well, I can remember, I had the distinction, I think I'm one of the few people left who has served on the President Clinton's National Security Council staff and President Bush's now. And under President Clinton's National Security Council, we called these states rogue nations. And I'm not sure I see such a sharp distinction between rogue nations and the axis of evil. I realize that halfway through, the administration shifted to states of concern, which I think probably didn't persuade anyone either. But I agree with Jim that a capricious demonization and deliberately poking the thumb in the eye of another state that you're trying to negotiate with, that serves no purpose. And the administration, we try not to do that. I think, though, in answer to your question about was this possible, Ahmadinejad accomplished one thing that he didn't intend to. And that is, he forged a very strong consensus among our EU3 partners that it was truly unacceptable for this regime to have nuclear weapons. And that conviction was not nearly as strong 2 years ago as it was after Ahmadinejad came to power. And that's crucial, because if there's going to be a diplomatic solution, it's going to be a combination of carrots and sticks. The U.S. has a lot of carrots it can offer in the non-military arena. But the sticks are primarily in the non-military arena. The sticks are primarily in the hands of the Europeans and the Chinese and the Russians. They are the ones that have extensive business deals with Iran. So if we're going to get a effective diplomatic carrots and sticks approach with Iran, it's going to require our colleagues, our European partners, to wield some of those sticks. They have the sticks. We don't have as many as they do. And what Ahmadinejad was able to accomplish was persuade them this is a serious matter that requires.
But what's interesting is that because the administration had good diplomacy beginning in the second term on Iran, we were able to take advantage of that. Secretary Rice made her first trip to Europe right after she was appointed and beginning the second term. She had come in with a very strong message. We're going to deal with this. It's too dangerous. She got to Europe, and to her credit, she heard what the Europeans were saying. She came back. She talked to the president, as I understand it. He said, look, if we're going to want them to do exactly what Peter is talking about, if push comes to shove, we better tone it down back. Get behind them. Show that we are supporting their diplomacy. And so we were well-placed when all our fears were being made very dramatically clear by Ahmadinejad's behavior, that the Europeans could say, hey, yeah, the U.S. has been playing ball with us, and we got to live up to our part of it, too. So I think it is precisely that example of how an alliance works together, taking each other's perspective together, understanding we're going to have different views, but if we want to be strong, we're strongest when we find common ground to do it.
And we have been better placed had the attempted back-channel talks with Iran not been shut down in the first term, the talks that Secretary Powell and others had clearly wanted.
You know, I think you can point to both Iran, and I would say even more with North Korea, and I don't want to put General Powell on the spot, but I think we saw the same thing happening in North Korea, in which we had a process moving forward with North Korea. And I don't want to excuse these regimes. They cheat, they lie, they mistreat their people. But we had a process going with North Korea, and there was a set of talks that were going on that Secretary Albright had started, and that General Powell talked about in his first weeks in office as a desirable thing to continue. And I think this kind of muscular sense that these are evil regimes that have to be dealt with, you know, at total arm's length, and they have to ultimately be gotten rid of, interfered with a process which may have not have borne fruit, but at least if it had failed, we would have had a stronger argument for going forward. That was the path that Secretary Perry had laid out with North Korea. Give him a stark choice. Say there is an opportunity.
Rather than his recent path.
Rather than his recent
shoot
path.
Them down.
But can I just, that's part of, Jim's got part of the argument, but there's another part that I would argue is even more important. The reason that the administration has resisted bilateral negotiations with Iran and bilateral negotiations with North Korea is my point about how our partners are the ones with the leverage over Iran. And in the case of North Korea, it's China and South Korea that have the leverage over North Korea. Iran and North Korea understand that, and that's why they would like to get those folks out of the negotiations and then be sitting at the table alone, just facing the United States only with non-military carrots or military sticks. And that's a bargaining that puts the United States at a disadvantage. What we'd much rather be doing is sitting at the table with our friends and partners who have non-military sticks to wield. And this is the crucial bit, they have skin in the game. So what we did with Iran was we let EU3 have the lead in negotiations with Iran so that when Iran was stiffing the world community, they weren't just stiffing the United States. And, of course, everyone would say the United States deserves to be stiffed, so they side with Iran. They were stiffing the Europeans, and the Europeans got skin in the game. In the same way, the six-party talks were structured so that China would have skin in the game with North Korea. And when North Korea defied the six-party talks, they were defying not the United States, but they were defying China, and they were defying South Korea. And that's a crucial bit of the multilateral, that's a crucial tactic in the negotiations that...
But there's the flip side. I mean, obviously, it's clearly desirable to have them involved. But the problem now, particularly with North Korea, is that the North Koreans say they want to talk to us. Ultimately, I believe we will have to talk to them bilaterally. And all of these other countries are saying, yeah, we'd like you to do it too. So I would not like to abandon the six-party framework. I think it's an incredibly valuable framework. But we're, in effect, giving an excuse to South Korea and China because they say, look, you know, you're not pursuing all the avenues of diplomacy. And we're solidarity. We're all together. But we, the six, or the five, think you should be having bilateral talks to complement the multilateral talks. There was some movement in that direction with Chris Hill. I think we should be prepared to do more. It's also not surprising, I think, that once we move forward with a greater willingness to talk to Tehran, the North Koreans said, hey, wait about us, and how come you're not paying attention here?
With that, Chris Hill, this week, in the last couple of days, he's now in Seoul, but in Beijing yesterday and the day before, he really got pushback. With the Chinese really refusing to step up to the plate. And as the main players, who, as you say, have skin in the game, who have been providing the majority by far of North Korea's oil and food, How do we get China to step up on some of these issues? Bill Clinton, parenthetically, in answer to that question that I posed last night, said, let's push them at the Security Council on Darfur and see whether they're willing to veto a resolution. You know, when does China, with its huge economic potential, have to also play the role of taking responsibility for regional disputes?
Well, and this is how we've formulated this exact concept. Deputy Secretary Zelek coined the phrase responsible stakeholder, and that our goal for China is to emerge as a responsible stakeholder in the international system with the emphasis on responsible. That is, they take a role in international fora like the United Nations, six-party talks, that are commensurate with their growing political clout. I would say, since I know the negotiations are still ongoing, that it's too soon to say that they have rebuffed the efforts. There's negotiations going on, and they are pressing us in one way, we're pressing them in another way, and I'm hopeful that by when the time comes over the next couple days, is my guess it'll be over the next couple days, that the Chinese will join us. And I think they will join us in part because they have had a major role in the six-party talks up until now. In other words, the strategy that has brought us to this point will be crucial for carrying us the final couple yards. Now, I would be not serving Karl Rove well if I didn't point out that this administration has gotten a lot of criticism for our approach in North Korea and in Iran by folks who have called it outsourcing our foreign policy. That is to say, this multilateralism, which Jim and I have just been endorsing, has been called outsourcing foreign policy by folks on the other side. I don't think that kind of language...
It's also been called outsourcing by people on that side. I think there are a lot of conservative Republicans don't like relying on it. Look, I think that what Peter's talking about is exactly right. In some ways, the Iran model is what we need to do here with China, which is to say, okay, let's reach a meeting of the minds. You want us to pursue a certain amount of diplomacy. Here's what we're prepared to do. But if we're going to do that, we need to know that if that fails, here's what you're going to do. And that's what I think happened with the U.S. and EU on Iran. By the way, in my example of Kosovo, that's what happened with the Europeans. We said, look, we're going to go to Rambouillet. We think it's a disaster. It's, you know, we're going to look ridiculous negotiating with these guys. But we will do it if we have an understanding from you that if Milosevic doesn't take this deal, we are going to be together and using stronger measures. And they came along. And I think that we have to be clear to China. They can't simply walk away from the problem, but we have to be willing to at least go part of the way towards their view about how to handle the situation, because their interests are not identical. They don't want a nuclear North Korea, but they also don't want to collapse North Korea. And they want some assurances, frankly, from us that our objective is not to collapse North Korea.
And let's be clear.
In fact, aren't they more afraid of a collapsed North Korea than a nuclear North Korea?
I think they would probably rate that as a greater fear for them, and that's one of the challenges. But let's also be clear that we have been doing in North Korea what we offered to do in Iran. That is to say, we were already at the table in the six-party talks with North Korea, and that was the strategic gambit that was offered to Iran, that we would join, not in a bilateral sense, but we would join the multilateral negotiations that up until this point we had been not joining, just sort of supporting from a distance. So we are creating something like a six-party construct in Iran, provided that Iran suspends its enrichment. The reason being that if Iran is allowed to continue to enrich, then they have an incentive to string this rug merchant, negotiations indefinitely. And so they're happily haggling over price while they're enriching uranium and then crossing the point of no return.
I agree with Peter on that, and I wonder if the administration wouldn't consider the same approach with North Korea, so they would stop producing plutonium for their nuclear bombs while we move these negotiations forward.
We won't put Peter completely on the spot on that. Let me ask you about Russia. While you drink, we've got a week before this summit with Russia in St. Petersburg, the G8, being hosted by Russia. There's a report in today's Washington Post by Peter Baker, which I have not independently confirmed, that we are now prepared to offer, and it will be announced at the summit, for the first time, a civilian nuclear deal with Russia, that we've gotten past our concerns about the Russia support for the Bashir nuclear reactor in Iran, and that this is a way of giving them an incentive to be more forward-leaning on Iran and other negotiations. I know it's not going to be announced yet, but Jim, there's been bipartisan opposition to this in the past. is this now a good idea? Is this the time to be rewarding Putin, given all of his recent rollbacks on democratic reforms?
I think it depends. And I think I don't know the details of the proposal. So, but let me tell you the proposal that I would support and what I wouldn't. I think it's we are at a crisis in the Non-Proliferation Treaty right now. We have a regime which had, at its core, a bargain that said countries would give up the right to have nuclear weapons in return for being supported and being shared technology for civilian nuclear power. What we really hadn't thought about at the time when the treaty was developed was that if you develop the civilian nuclear power, you're just a step or two away from having a nuclear weapon. And that the whole idea that countries could have what's called the full fuel cycle from producing the material for the nuclear reactor through the waste products which could be reprocessed puts everybody on the doorstep of being a nuclear power. So there have been discussions with Russia about coming to a new approach where we would say to countries in the world, look, yes, you can have civilian nuclear reactors, but you can't have the full fuel cycle. We're going to provide the fuel. We're going to safeguard it when you get it. We're going to monitor it while you're there, and we're going to take it out while it's gone. We have talked to the Russians a lot about their being one of the repositories where they both produce the fuel because they've got an awful lot of the stuff, surplus from the nuclear weapons program and from their plants, and you store it. And you become sort of part of an international system that tries to deal with this deep, deep flaw in the NPT. If what the president is talking about is supporting a program that would allow the Russians to play a more active role in that, and it was trying to revive and resuscitate the NPT in a way that said to all of the countries that are not nuclear weapons, look, that old deal can't work, we've got to have a new one, then I would be supportive. If this is simply just, you know, we need to do something together with the Russians and this is important to them, then I'd have a lot more reservations about it.
Well, we have... The administration has two preemption doctrines. The one is the doctrine that's outlined in the national security strategy. The other one is that you get fired if you preempt the president on a presidential announcement. And so
You get a pass on this.
I'll be happy to return next week and explain it. Okay. I would love to come back to
that. That's what's called a non-denial denial.
But I will address because this issue is directly raised in the Indian civilian nuclear deal, where some folks have said that this breaks or unduly challenges the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And I don't see it that way. India, for 30 years or so, was a de facto nuclear power. We can't roll that back. And under the status quo ante, before this civilian nuclear deal was struck, none of the Indian nuclear program was under safeguards. With this deal, a good portion of the program is now under safeguards. And I think that is, on balance, a good deal, not just for U.S.-Indian relations, which would make it valuable in itself, but I think it's also a good deal for non-proliferation efforts more broadly, because before, India was completely outside of the regime. Now it's at least coming under some of the safeguards. And I think that kind of pragmatic approach, which is how I would interpret Jim's description of the ideal kind of arrangement, I think that is guiding administration efforts in the last couple of years.
The problem, just to say a word on the India deal, is that while there are certainly positive aspects to it, the difficulty is because some of the facilities are not being safeguarded, in effect what we're doing is we're providing nuclear materials for the civilian reactors, so they are now free to use the material they would otherwise have to use for the civilian reactors to build bombs. And so if the administration had coupled this with the requirement that the Indians stop producing additional fissile material, a position that the administration, I think, supports, fissile material cutoff, then we would have had a situation where we got the pragmatic acceptance of India's nuclear program, which I agree we had to do. I mean, it's just crazy to pretend that they're not there, and there are lots of reasons to want to engage with them on this. But I worry that what we've done is we basically made it easier for them to continue a nuclear arms race in South Asia, which surely Pakistan is going to match, and that's in nobody's interest.
And let me return you both to Putin and the march toward democracy and how it is going in Russia. Most recently, the Russian government has forced through new regulations its broadcasters to drop Voice of America and other American government English language broadcasts, which have been, you know, for decades our way of communicating directly to the people in that country and other parts of what used to be, of course, the East Bloc. this is only the latest example. There's the Klebnikov case. There are the other cases of what Putin has been doing in terms of retreating from the very democratic principles that are supposed to be the foundation of the G8 group. So one wonders why at this point are we rewarding Putin with this summit, and why are we so eager to soft pedal our disagreements with the Russians?
Well, the democracy challenge in Russia is a serious one. And the problem is that for many Russians, including the young entrepreneurial class that would be the bedrock of a fully democratic Russia, for many of them, they equate the word democracy with the chaos of the Yeltsin years and the very, very strong embrace that the United States made of Yeltsin. It, in some respects, dams the democracy project in their mind, because they remembered the Yeltsin years unfavorably as chaotic, as a time when Russia was exploited, when Russia didn't get the respect it was due, et cetera, et cetera. And so some of our natural allies among the Russian people have themselves an ambivalent feeling about some of the democracy project. At the same time, I'm firmly convinced that they want the political and the economic freedoms that we mean when we talk about democracy. So part of it is finding a way of talking about democracy with the Russian people and with Putin that gets us over this sort of Yeltsin memory hump. The president is very firm with Putin, but doesn't view public hectoring of Putin as an effective way of pressing the democracy agenda. It's sort of the corollary of Jim's point about needlessly provoking other states by calling them bad names. You don't necessarily move Putin effectively by going to Moscow and publicly hectoring him. On the other hand, you don't move him by denying realities. And so the vice president gave that speech where he laid out what we see and our concerns. And it's a delicate balance of negotiations of private pressure on Putin, but a public description of the reality and the national security strategy. We sort of try to thread the needle there by describing what we see. And the hope is that plus an energized conversation with the Russian people will move this ball along.
Let me just say parenthetically that speech by the vice president led to the foreign minister Lavrov excoriating Secretary Rice and Nicholas Burns at a private dinner at the United Nations on May 12th.
Well, let me say, because I wanted to say something about that, because I basically agree with the strategy that Peter is talking about, and I think President Bush is right to go to the summit for precisely the reasons that Peter said, because not going is a sign of disrespect, not to Putin, but to Russia. And this is important for a country that has lost its standing in the world, and for the Russian people, who are proud people and see themselves as an important player and actor. So I think going, but also being candid while you're there, is quite important. I remember it was a wonderful performance by General Powell when he went to Moscow early in his time as Secretary of State, and he went on to Echo Moskvy and talked to the Russian people about why we saw these issues and why democracy was important. That's the right way to do it. I disagree with the way the vice president did it. You don't go to a country which has deep tensions with Russia. I mean, I'm an enormous supporter of the Baltic countries. They've done heroic things. But it was done for a very deliberate, provocative measure to go there and to say it that way. And it was seen that way. And again, I don't want to defend Lavrov and those guys because they're kind of old-fashioned.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you really want to?
No, I don't. So I think Peter's strategy is exactly the right one. I think the president should go. He should find a way to talk to civil society that's there. By the way, although, again, I don't condone closing down the broadcast media, Russians, even less than the Chinese, can cut the Russian people off from information, the Internet, the other sources of information. We're in a day where Voice of America and those things are still good to do, and I still support them, but they are far less important because there are so many other avenues. And so we can get our message out, and we need to do exactly what Peter said, which is to show our deep disagreements with Putin, both on domestic and foreign policy, but our respect for the aspirations of the Russian people to have order, to have a good life. I mean, they saw their society fall apart, and they understandably wanted somebody to make it better. Unfortunately, Putin has exploited this in favor of deep repression at home and bad policies, especially in the so-called near abroad. And we need to talk. We need to speak up about those.
Can we expect that there will be candid conversation, public conversation, or frank conversation? Or
I'm highly confident that the president will be candid and truthful, and I can state that with great confidence.
Let me turn to the Middle East, where frankly,
I don't think I persuaded anyone in the audience.
Frankly, the United States does not seem to have a presence right now in the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. Now, maybe we don't want one, but with the election of Hamas, we seem to have decided that we can be bystanders, and there hasn't been any really energetic diplomacy. Now, this, as I say, this may be, deliberate. Maybe it is a losing proposition, and we want to wait to see what happens with Hamas, but critics would say that this thing is veering out of control, that the Palestinian government could easily collapse over this, and that Israel won't have any partner to negotiate with. Now, again, Israeli officials have told me that's a good thing in this current administration. They have said, let them kill each other off. But right now, what is happening in Gaza has, in fact, united Fatah and Hamas more than it had been in previous weeks. So I'm just unclear as to what you see, what both of you see as the appropriate U.S. role in Middle East diplomacy.
Well, I'm not sure I accept the premise that there hasn't been an active U.S. diplomatic role. There hasn't been a very public sort of shuttle diplomacy in the old Kissingerian sense, but there has been a very active behind-the-scenes diplomatic role, and that, I think, is the way to deal with the situation there, that sometimes a very public U.S. role can be the catalyst for seizing the moment, and sometimes a very public U.S. role, can be used by the parties involved to offload responsibility onto the U.S., and then have the U.S. blamed for the failure. And so that becomes a matter of diplomatic tactics. And I think the behind-the-scenes approach which we're taking probably has a better chance of success. But let's back up and remember where we were with Hamas before the election. Before the election, Hamas had a tremendous amount of influence in the Palestinian territories. And there was very little leverage that outsiders had over Hamas. After the elections, Hamas has a lot of influence in the territories, but now we have points of leverage over Hamas, and that was what was happening up in the last 2-3 months has been that leverage being applied to the Hamas government to pressure them exactly the way President Clinton said
now,
last night.
Everyone in the administration would tell us that we and the Israelis were completely surprised by the Hamas victory. It was not predicted.
Right.
Perhaps we could argue that our intelligence should have been a little bit better because the way the Fatah election process was structured, if you looked at it really intelligently, it was almost inevitable that Hamas would win because they had those double teams of candidates. But you're suggesting that the buy-in into the political process by Hamas is a good thing.
No,
they're part of the process and we can deal with them, we have leverage over them?
Well, I'm describing the situation before Hamas made the choice of volleying hundreds of rockets into Israel. But in the weeks after the election, that was not what the U.S. expected. It's also not what Hamas expected, by the way.
Right.
While you could call it an intelligence failure, let's point out that in the United States, where we have a long practice of predicting elections, we sometimes get it wrong in the U.S. So it's probably not surprising that in one of the first elections in the Palestinian territories, they weren't able to predict
it. You don't get it wrong. We get it wrong.
Yes. but my point was when Hamas got into power, that gave us meaning the international community, points of leverage over Hamas that we didn't have before. And that was what those levers were being applied to Hamas. And there was some pressure on it, and you saw that with the referendum that Abbas was presenting, that this was going to be a chance to sort of rally the Palestinian people behind a two-state solution. There was progress being made until Hamas made the strategic error, I believe, to escalate the fight militarily.
And let me talk about the broader point, because the one thing I do disagree with Peter on is the question whether this is a question of tactics or whether it's a view about the U.S. role. Because I do think that the administration made a profound mistake at the beginning of the administration stepping back from this process. I assume that most people in the administration didn't share the view, but you'll recall that Ari Fleischer blamed the Intifada on President Clinton's intervention. And there was a series of statements in the early going that said, parties aren't ready, we can't be more peace more than the parties, and we're going to step back from this. And I think it creates a vacuum. And I think that the history of the region and the views of the parties has been that ultimately the United States is indispensable for creating the context and has to be involved. And while many of us lived very directly through the Camp David experience, and there's no guarantee that our involvement is going to bring a solution to the problem. But I share President Clinton's view of this, that, boy, we ought to get caught dead trying. And I do think that there was a sense that, well, we could step back from this, that it would kind of work its way out, that people would get tired, and finally the time would get ripe again. But instead, things just fell apart. An opportunity came when Prime Minister Sharon, when the Prime Minister finally came forward with his proposal for unilateral withdrawal. And then what we had again an opportunity to step in, because the president, I think, correctly supported the idea that we ought to have a peace process that allowed Israel to recognize that there were going to have to be changes to the original 67 borders. But there was not then a follow-up to say, but we also have to recognize that there are needs on the Palestinian side and work with the Palestinians and the Egyptians and others to try to round out that statement of support for the unilateral disengagement to create a context for negotiations. As a result, nothing went forward. And again, there's no guarantee that we would have been able to reach an agreement, or there could have been a more coordinated approach to unilateral disagreement, to disengagement. But it's the sort of the sense of how much the United States needs to be there, not simply for the interests of the parties, although it matters the interests of the parties, but also because the United States has interest in having this. It's very damaging to us to have the conflict to spin out of control. And interestingly, at the times that the administration has come in, around the end of the period of the disengagement, when Secretary Rice was in Jerusalem and helped negotiate the agreement that allowed the EU to come in and deal with opening the border crossings into Egypt, we got an agreement. It was a terrific success. And when I was there at the time, just by coincidence, and I thought, wow, we have a new era here of engagement. We have an opportunity. But then it slipped away again. And I think it is that sense of the need for the United States to be in there, to recognize that we can't solve the problem for the parties, but we can play an indispensable role in trying to make this work. And I think that's an approach that we need to engage in again.
I mean, if you look at the situation right now, the World Food Program announced today that there is a critical need to maintain open access to Gaza because of the food and fuel situation there. It's clear that this whole latest crisis began with the capture of Shalit, the Israeli soldier. So there's no question who started this round. But now we've had 45 Palestinians dead. Yesterday that included a mother and her two small children. The firing, I mean, there's no way here that we should even be talking about whose fault or who started it. But in terms of the U.S. role, the Army of Islam is this new, rather small terror group now claiming that Hamas should be more religiously focused, less secular, and that Hamas is wrong to be part of the government. And so they are now adapting al-Qaeda tactics for the first time to the Palestinian cause in some of these recent killings. So hasn't the situation gotten so much worse in the last couple of weeks? Isn't it at the stage where the United States has to do something and not be behind the scenes?
Well, I don't see behind-the-scenes pressure and behind-the-scenes diplomatic activity as doing nothing. I mean, I guess maybe Jim and I fundamentally disagree on that point. I would see, I would characterize that as doing something, but doing something in a way that advances the ball practically. If you're asking, should the U.S. intervene militarily. I don't think
By being, by sending someone, by the secretary going, by taking a stronger position.
Yes. I mean, I do think we have to do that. I think we, and I think that, I mean, both parties are now in an impossible situation. And that's exactly when third-party intervention is necessary. I completely understand the Israeli frustration and the need to sort of recognize that, that they cannot simply walk away from a security problem. On the other hand, and it's unfortunate, they are playing right into, I don't know whether there really is this Islamic army movement or whether it's just the hardliners in Damascus who didn't like some pragmatic things they were saying from the Hamas party in the territories. But nonetheless, I mean, somebody talked the other day in one of the panels about looking at the poll numbers and how, you know, although Hamas had gotten all these votes, in fact,
President Clinton.
And the irony, and I thought to myself, you know, those numbers are so good. Who wanted to drive those numbers down? Mm-hmm. Who are the bad guys who wanted to drive those numbers down? And it's happened. So the hardliners, the people who don't want to see any possibility of Hamas being more political or trying to get Fatah back into the game, or the prisoner agreement, which might have provided a basis along with Abbas's referendum to go forward, there, whether it's an al-Qaeda group or hardliners in Damascus, unfortunately, the understandable reaction of Omar to protect his people is exactly what they wanted to happen, and so those numbers have gone down. And once again, we'll have to pick up those pieces. We and the sooner we intervene, we can't solve it, but we can provide a context to get a ceasefire, to give, find a way to get Israel out of there, to provide a context in which this can happen. I think the parties in the region would welcome that happening. It's complicated. It's tricky. You risk, you know, being viewed as talking to terrorists and the like. But I think it benefits both the moderate Palestinians and the Israeli government for some kind of framework to emerge now with active U.S. involvement to try to find out a way this horrible downward spiral, which is only helping the hardliners, and that can't be a result that we want to see.
I wanted to bring the audience in with questions. I don't know if there are microphones or if this wonderful auditorium. Unfortunately, we can't see from up here. So there are microphones on either side. So please join in. And I see someone coming to this microphone right here.
Yes, let me suggest to you one possibility and ask what your thought is. None of this kidnapping type action by Hamas happened until Abbas said we're going to have a referendum. And it kind of sounded as if he had a lot of the Palestinian people behind him for that referendum. And suddenly that's announced, a date is set, and what do you know, next thing Hamas is tunneling into Israel and they're kidnapping people. Could this not be a ploy by the Hamas government to kind of sabotage this whole referendum and to keep there from being a Palestinian vote on it?
I think that was Jim's
I'm sure it's, whoever was behind it, that's exactly what their intention was. What I don't know, and maybe Peter has some more insight from the intelligence, as to whether how much the government was behind it. There is some evidence that it was either this new group or a splinter group. But clearly, the objective here was precisely that, because there was an opportunity to get things back on track, and because there is such a deep groundswell of support among Palestinians and Israelis to find a way out of this impasse. And I think that's why the tragedy is here, that while the Israelis clearly needed to respond, that they weren't able to find a way to do this that didn't play into the hands of the people who provoked it in the first place.
And just to explain what Jim is saying, there are two wings to Hamas. There is the political wing that ran in the elections and then won a plurality and thus could form the parliamentary government. There's the military, and that was based in the Palestinian territories. And then there's the military wing, the leader of which is based in Damascus. And the intelligence challenge is, who's driving the ship? Is it the military wing or the political wing? And I think most people think that the military wing at least is able to drive the train in terms of these latest provocations.
And I think we don't want to be Pollyannish about this. Even among the political wing, there's some pretty bad actors too. So I want to be realistic about this. But there does seem to be at least some difference in emphasis. And certainly with the political wing, there may be some reason to hope that they would be more willing to accept the past agreements, whereas the military wing clearly is rejectionist and absolutist in that respect.
Thank you. Yes.
I have two questions, one on the Middle East and one on the Iran situation. Yesterday, President Clinton said to us that he thought it was pretty obvious the outcome, and there would be a deal, or there was finally going to be a deal, and we all knew the answer, plus or minus 3%. So I wonder if both of you might care to comment on what you think that outcome is, plus or minus 3%. And on the Iran conflict, it seems pretty clear that both options on the outside, the do-nothing or the military action, are both unworkable, and we've taken this middle ground. But with regards to the group of players, ourselves, the Europeans, the Chinese, and the Russians, it seems to me that our carrots don't have any currency with the Iranians, and our carrots probably have only currency with the others that are involved in that negotiations. And in particular, with the price of oil, the Chinese certainly could take up the purchase of oil from Iran. So what carrots do we have with those others to help bring this conflict or the situation with Iran to a better place?
Do you want to take the Middle East first, the 3% solution?
Well, this president was the first president to say that there will be a two-state solution, that at the end, that was implied, of course, by the Camp David Accords, but it wasn't stated publicly, and President Bush stated it publicly. But it was in the process of dealing with Yasser Arafat that the freedom agenda and the emphasis on democracy that this administration has made emerged. And I'm not sure this is widely known, but it was in the context of negotiating with Arafat, where Arafat would say one thing privately to us, and then another thing privately to his cabinet, and a third thing to his people. And the president said, how can we have a partner for peace who is basically lying to us on a consistent basis? We need someone who will be accountable to, and the president deduced the solution is to have someone who is accountable in a democratic sense, because then that they won't be able to pull that stunt. And that's where the emphasis on we need a democratic Palestinian partner for the two-state solution. And the whole freedom agenda emerged out of that. I know Secretary Albright, it emerged out of us reading her memoirs, but it emerged really in the nitty-gritty of negotiating on that two-state solution. Do you want to comment more?
I can't resist, because we haven't talked about the topic of the administration's democratization strategy, but it's an important issue about U.S. leadership, and I'll get to your questions. It's so important. I think we should say something about it here. I think that there is a broad consensus that, one, it is in the United States' interest to see democracy expand around the world, and, two, the United States has a role to play in doing that. That having been said, how we do that and what our expectations are enormously important. We did get the democracy agenda in the Palestinian territory, and we got Hamas. And we are going to have to recognize that in the near term, a democratic, that is an electoral democratic agenda, is going to produce Hamas's, Muslim Brotherhood's, Ahmadinejad's, and a lot of people that we don't like. And so we have to recognize as we go forward that while we do need a long-term strategy here, it isn't going to happen simply because we announce that there's going to be a democracy, or worse, that we try to impose democracy. It has created some complications. Again, not that we should back off from it, but we should understand that it is a very complex world that we're going into. And precisely when I talk about the engagement in the Middle East, you know, Hamas is a very ugly organization. But on the one hand, we support a process that gets them elected and then said we won't talk to them. If it had been me, I would have said, we'll talk to you, but let's understand, one, that what we do with you depends on what you do. So in the first instance, there was a ceasefire going on. We should have insisted that they, if they want to talk, then that's how we talk in the context of the ceasefire, and that we begin to develop some understandings about how we proceed forward. That's the only way I think the democracy agenda could work. On the 3% solution, I mean, I, the way I would put it is that if there's ever going to be a solution, that's it. And it recognizes two facts, which is, one, the geography has changed. There are parts of the pre-67 areas that Israel will never get up. They're heavily settled. They are so integral to political, social life of Israel that those will not change. On the other hand, there are large parts of the settlements that are not integral, and that while it will be a tough political decision, just like disengagement from Gaza, that should be a reasonable expectation. And what's more, that there ought to be able to be some territorial compensation that makes it go forward. The problem is, even within the 3% solution, there are really difficult issues like how you deal with Jerusalem and all those which are still up in the air. Nonetheless, I think there is a belief that there are there are significant majorities on both sides that in a period of calm would probably live with that. And then the question is, will the saboteurs, like the militant wing of Hamas in Damascus, ever allow that to happen? And I just don't know the answer to that. I hope over time, if we can create a context in which people have a stake in stability and peace, that there will be greater support. But we will have to continually deal with these challenges of people who are trying to bomb the peace process away. That's what happened in 1996 in the elections in Israel, when you had Shimon Peres running to succeed Rabin, in effect. We had a huge bombing campaign because there was a deep fear by the hardliners that if Peres got in, we might actually get an agreement. And so, I mean, to say that that's the outlines, yes, that is the only plausible solution. But getting there, I think, is you know, quite a difficult challenge to think about how you make the process work.
And do you want to address whether or not we have any real carrots with Iran?
Oh, I think, why don't you have to?
Well, let me also say that I agree with Jim that we have to understand the nuances of the democracy promotion, and I encourage folks to read the National Security Strategy, where we lay that out. And I think I would encourage folks to read what we've written on the subject and not what other people say we've said on the subject. Now, on the Iran, and that wasn't meant as a swipe at you. I'll tell you when I'm taking a swipe at you. That wasn't one of them. On Iran, we do have carrots. The offer has not been publicly described, but it's officially. But there's been a lot of reports in the press that it's a generous offer to Iran, and it would be good for the Iranian people. And that's about as far as I can go in characterizing it. But there's no question that if the regime accepted the offer that has been tabled to them, that it would be good for the Iranian people. It would lead to the Iranian people getting all the things that they rightfully want, and it would also prevent this regime from developing a nuclear weapon. It would do all of those things if the Iranian regime accepted it. And that's the real test we're facing is the Iranian regime willing to give up a nuclear weapon in exchange for getting all of the other advantages that's being offered to it? It's a good deal. And we'll find out what is the bottom line of this of the Iranian regime. Now, there are non-military levers over the Iranians. I do not subscribe to the view that we can only offer them carrots or bomb them, and there's nothing in between, no pressure in between. On the contrary, the Iranian regime has not. This is where Iran is very different from Iraq. Iraq experienced international isolation for 12 years. Iran has not. Iran has experienced U.S. isolation, but international engagement. And so there's a lot of economic commerce that Iran depends on that could be put at risk if the world community enforced the deal that's being presented to the Iranians, and that kind of pressure on the Iranian regime might be enough to adjust their cost-benefit calculation to the point where they'd accept the deal. So there are a lot of
those. I agree with Peter on that, and I think that the big question here, and I say this mindful that Alan Greenspan is sitting there, that is that right now the Iranians believe that we are more afraid of their taking the oil off the market than we are willing to, you know, take the risk of putting it to them and playing this game of chicken over the economic consequences. I think it's a mistake. I'm not an economic modeler. I've seen some assessments about what would happen in the near term before markets adjusted, and there is obviously a great tightness in oil markets right now. Nonetheless, we need to make clear to the Iranians that we are prepared to take that price, even if it means a short-term $100 a barrel or whatever, if they are not prepared to come to the table. And we can do that. We have the economic tools to play the game of chicken, to damage them. And what they're coming back and saying is, well, if you do this to us, this is what we'll do to you. We'll either mine the Straits of Hormuz or we'll withdraw. And it's a tough game. But unless because I do think I don't think it's immediate, I do think it's incredibly serious. We have to be prepared to say, are we prepared to take the hit to the global economy that would come, at least in the short term, from saying there are real costs to you as well as real benefits. Cost if you don't go down a reasonable road, benefits if you do. And I think we need to be clear, and I think we need to do this with the Europeans and the Japanese and others, to say, yes, there is. We're not doing this today, tomorrow, but don't underestimate our willingness to play this game if we have to. And it's certainly better than the military option.
And this gets us back to the theme of the panel, because the we in Jim's words there, is not just we, the United States, but it's we and our partners, because they are the ones who have that leverage over the Iranians more so than the United States has at this point.
If they come along. Yes, sir.
David Devlin-Foltz from the Institute. I appreciated your analogy to allies as in-laws. And my wife's cousins in Indiana, like most Americans, embrace a couple of values that we think are important about how the U.S. behaves in the world. One is that we be good team players, and another is that we're involved in things that work. And so the comments earlier about formal multilateral institutions and their occasional shortcomings is important here. How do we go about best encouraging effective reform of those multilateral institutions? And I can't resist asking, is our current ambassador an effective instrument of that?
Well, I think that that unilateral, informal, multilateral, and multilateral work together in tandem, and one strengthens the other. Let me give you an example. In the immediate aftermath of the tsunami, the formal international institutions that provide that kind of relief were unable to act fast enough. They just didn't have the logistics capability. The only folks that did were the United States and some immediate coalition of the willing, which provided a bridge so that we could respond in the immediate, and that's why U.S. was there firstest, with the soonest, with the mostest. But the long-term solution was handing it over to the international organizations that do this and can do it on a sustained basis better. So there's one way they can work in tandem. Another way they work in tandem is where the threat to do it unilaterally or the threat to do it without in an informal way goads the formal institution into acting. I hate to bring up Iraq again, but that is exactly how we got the United Nations to take Iraq seriously in 2002 in the way that it hadn't in 2001 or 2000 or 1999. It was the belief that the United States was going to go unilaterally outside of the UN that got the UN to act on Iraq and got us to 1441. So there's that kind of tandem. The PSI is another good example of a sort of a results-based international institution as opposed to a process-based international institution. But the UN exists, and this is where we are in a different place than, say, the Truman administration, which was inventing international institutions on a relatively blank slate. We are in a new era, which I would argue is very similar to the early years of the Cold War, but with one important difference, that the institutional landscape is very crowded. And you can't simply invent new institutions because existing institutions have a strong inertial weight behind them, and they empower actors in a way that those actors like. And so that requires trying to make these existing institutions adapt to the new era. And that's what the UN reform effort is about. I think that Bolton is effective at pushing that forward. And just 2 weeks ago, he pulled a rabbit out of his hat on an issue where folks didn't think we were going to be able to get a deal. It wasn't Iran-related. It was a different issue. And he was a very tough but effective negotiator in accomplishing that. And so I actually think he would be able to do that. He also would be very effective at selling a UN reform deal to the U.S. Congress. And so if UN is able to step up to the plate and do that, I think Bolton would be very effective in selling that to the U.S. Congress. And this was the question I wanted someone to ask Shashi. He was talking all about the need for global governance. This was a couple, I guess, 2 days ago. I was hoping someone asked him about UN reform, and he didn't step up to it. I'm not sure that there is the commitment amongst all the member states of the UN to reform the UN in the way that it needs to be reformed.
Jim, do you want to
talk? Yeah. I'm all for tough love as long as there's a little love in the tough. And I you know, I really worry about this because, let me give you an example, and I don't know whether this is Bolton or others, but last year there was a process leading to the summit at the UN, and it was a very complex negotiation around it with everybody had their own priorities. And we had UN reform as our priority, and some of the developing countries had moving forward on the Millennium Development Goals as their priority, and there were a lot of other things in the mix. And we came, and for reasons which are just absolutely baffling to me, we came with a proposal, the United States, came with a proposal to basically roll back the Millennium Development Goals. At the same time, we were trying to get other countries in the world to buy our very tough but very needed reforms to the UN. Well, surprise, surprise. We created an environment in which it was very, very difficult, but it, as Peter says, people have a stake in it. And unless we are prepared to sort of say, okay, how do we work these things through? How do we reach compromises? We wouldn't reach a compromise on the Human Rights Council. We have not been willing to sort of make to avoid making the best the enemy of the good. And because these institutions are all going to be flawed and second best, we basically got to decide, are we going to support them? Now, to defend the president, one of the least remarked but very important speeches that the president has ever given was, I think it was last year at the General Assembly, when the president gave a wonderful speech talking about how important the UN was and its value. And he got a terrific reception at the UN. Didn't get a lot of coverage. Well, I thought it was a terrific speech, and I do think it's the reflection of the hand of Peter and other sane heads that are beginning to prevail. But that it was noticed in New York, and then we had this whole other episode. So I do think that there is an appreciation. And the president just said it the other day. I forget the context, but he was talking about the value of the UN. And so, but if we're going to do it, we simply have to recognize that we can't be the 800-pound gorilla all the time. We can take our marbles and go home, but then we won't have these institutions reformed, improved, even within the limits that are possible.
Yes, ma'am.
I've been listening to this talk about multilateralism.
Hi, it's me.
Multilateralism and the glories of multilateralism. And I just want to wonder what happened to bilateralism, especially on the stickiest issues we face. You think about North Korea, where we are reduced now to sitting on the side and hoping a six-party process gets started again when the sixth party won't show up at the table and instead shoots off missiles. You think of Iran, where we are relegated to basically hoping that back-channel conversations happen that never quite happen. And I think of Darfur, where we have ceded or hoped to cede some sort of control to the African Union, and yet there is no movement, so little movement that even John Danforth was forced to resign in frustration because he felt the United Nations was moving so slowly. I wonder, just turning this whole concept on its head, whether there isn't room anymore for bilateralism and whether bilateralism with the U.S. as the one person always at the table is now dead.
Well, no, I think bilateralism is important and is the foundation for multilateral institutions. But what I mean by bilateralism is, say, the U.S. bilateral relationship with Japan or the U.S. bilateral relationship with Britain or with Canada. Those.
But what about talking to our enemies? What about talking to the people who are creating the rogue nations, the states of concern?
That's what you're asking about, I take it. Right. Here's the danger in that. That when the U.S. is at the table alone with the other side, then it becomes the U.S.'s problem alone to bear. And this, the U.S. has said that we will talk with Iran in the context of the multilateral EU3 negotiations. The U.S. is willing to talk to North Korea within the context of the six-party talks. So it's not a case of unwilling to talk to the enemy, but it's avoiding the trap of being bilaterally stuck so that all of the responsibility for success or failure, therefore all of the costs, have to be borne by the United States alone. Those kinds of negotiations are not effective when it's your allies that have the levers that are necessary to be wielded against, not against, but wielded on the party you're trying to negotiate with. So bilateral makes sense when there's no other party that has the leverage. So a U.S.-Soviet bilateral negotiations on arms control, I think that made sense in the Cold War context. But to try to persuade the North Koreans to peacefully give up their nuclear weapons or to persuade the Iranian regime peacefully to abandon a nuclear weapons program, we're going to need to put pressure on them, peaceful pressure that the United States alone can't put. We have to have the other allies there. And if you get into the bilateral trap, the other allies step back and say, okay, now it's your problem, and we'll applaud if you can pull it off.
It's just not an either-or, I think, as we were talking about earlier. I mean, at the end of the day, there are aspects of this that are regional, and there are certainly things that the others can bring to bear. But in the case of both Iran and North Korea, there are core issues that are only going to be settled.
And Sudan.
I think on Sudan, the big problem on Sudan is the question about whether it more is in the deployment of troops. I think we should definitely take this on, and I think Bob Zelik has. I mean, to his credit, we have dealt with that. All the old frameworks were EGAD and all that other, you know, multilateral stuff before, but the reality is that on a diplomatic level, Bob Zelik did it, and I applaud him for it. He got in, and he made it a priority. And, you know, we are not going to solve this by a unilateral deployment of U.S. troops, simply because I think in the context of Darfur, we need to have others there. We need to have other African countries. Arguably, we need to have other Muslim countries there. But on a diplomatic level, I mean, you can say maybe there's more, but I actually think in that kind of engagement, there's been significant leadership from the administration. We need to continue to push at the U.N.
Of course, Bob Zelik is gone.
Well, I hope that that his successor will have the same kind of commitment. But I applaud that as a bilateral U.S. initiative to get in. And it was not, you know, this was a huge credit to the administration because it wasn't driven by, you know, the war on terrorism or any of these other things. It was because it was the right thing to do. And he went. And we were talking before about U.S. engagement in the Middle East. Boy, he went, and it made a difference. The United States can make such a difference when it goes in. More needs to be done, I agree, but I also think that this is one where there has been an appreciation by the administration of the need to get involved.
All right, we have very little time, but let me ask your question, and we'll try to give you fast responses.
Thank you. My name is Jeffrey Nyarota. I'm a newspaper editor from Zimbabwe, currently living in exile in the United States. Now, I do understand the principle behind the campaign by the United States to spread democracy to distant parts of the world. What I don't understand, and I'm sure I speak on behalf of many other people in my part of the world, is the inertia that seems to afflict the United States when it comes to spreading democracy to countries such as my own, Robert Mugabe's Zimbabwe, where dictatorship has thrived for the past many years, where people have suffered, their civil rights abused, people have starved to death, but nothing ever seems to happen apart from the imposition of target sanctions on Mugabe and his regime, so that he cannot travel to countries such as the United States, which he does anyway once in a while when he comes to the United Nations.
So what is the moral requirement on the United States if we believe in what the president outlined in his second inaugural address, mm-hmm. to not ignore the plight of countries that perhaps don't have strategic importance but have this compelling need?
Well, the U.S. hasn't ignored Zimbabwe, and we have, the president has talked about it, the president has raised it. The countries, though, with leverage over Zimbabwe, South Africa, first and foremost, I would argue that the responsibility falls in large measure on the countries with the most leverage over Zimbabwe, so South Africa, Commonwealth countries, and so forth. And my question is, where's the outrage in those countries about the deplorable conditions that you describe, that you and I would both agree characterize the suffering in Zimbabwe? Why is it that the United States, if the United States doesn't act, no one else will act, and therefore it's the United States' fault? I know the president feels acutely that the people of Zimbabwe are suffering, and he has said as much on a number of occasions, but the U.S. leverage over Zimbabwe is not as great as South Africa's leverage over Zimbabwe. And so we would look for the regional players to be putting pressure on Mugabe to find an alternative.
Thank you. Did you have any
concerns? I mean, it is a very difficult problem. And I think it is one of the both the problems of multilateralism, getting back to Gwen's question, but also the necessary parts, which is to say that if we were to take this on, let's say we were going to do regime change in Zimbabwe, imagine what the global reaction would be, and would that net be better for this to be a U.S.-only project? So that's why the key is precisely why I believe we need to have strong international institutions and alliances so people come together around these so that these are not made in America propositions. When the initial democratization proposals were made, I mean, the president, I think, initially we were going to do it our way, and then there was at least an effort at Sea Island to try to bring this into a broader GA context. I think at the end of the day, if we're going to be effective in dealing with the Zimbabwes and all these other situations, we do have to have the others. Although there are things that we can do, sometimes our doing them will create such a backlash that the net benefit of our intervening could be even worse than the situation that exists. What we don't want to do is create sympathy for Mugabe by having this be a U.S. project that everybody else sees as just a hegemonic. We're picking and choosing. You're invading Zimbabwe, but not Saudi Arabia. I mean, this is precisely why having an international context with agreed international norms, having an international criminal court, who arguably you could go after a Mugabe for violations of humanitarian law, might be a way to get at it.
The ICC, I suspect it's going to have to be a subject for another tutorial. But I want to thank you very, very much, Jim and Peter. And we trust that nothing that Peter has said today will get you in trouble with Karl Rove. Thank you all very, very much. And thanks to the Aspen Institute for having us here.
Thank you.